tonight on Arena with me, Evelyn O'Rourke. Chris Thiele plays live in studio. We're talking about the new Irish film Abode and Anthony Burrell on the National Print Museum. You can text us on 51551. Our WhatsApp is at 087-032-3232. Email us at arena@rte.ie. And, jeepers, we're on the Instagram at RTE_arena2. So plenty of ways to get in touch with us. But starting this evening, we're joined in studio by the American musician, the acclaimed mandolin player and composer, Chris Thiele. He's returning to the National Concert Hall this Wednesday for a wide-ranging solo performance. Internationally renowned for his mandolin playing, he's a founding member of Nickel Creek and Punch Brothers and has collaborated with a number of artists, including Yo-Yo Ma. A wide-ranging musician, he ranges from country, classical and folk, and his current passion sees him explore Bach's sonatas and partitas, reshaping them through the voice of the mandolin. At the concert hall, he'll mix selections from his Bach recordings, including pieces from the forthcoming second volume, with folk, classical and improvisational threads that run through his career. Phew, Chris, that is some list. I'm delighted to welcome you to studio now.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Listen, after that big, long, impressive intro, we're going to hear you play a little bit. Maybe you'd introduce this tune to us, The Fox. Why this?
Absolutely. Well, so my mom used to sing this to me when I was a little boy to help me go to sleep, which I think once you hear it, maybe a little counterintuitive. but it's, you know, it's an old British Isles folk tune. I grew up playing a whole lot of Irish music, actually. A big fan of Planxty in particular. And so I just ate, slept, and breathed that music. And so I would try and improvise a little bit with The Fox in a way that maybe you'll be familiar to some of y'all.
Went out on a chilly night, and he prayed for the moon to give him light for many a mile to go that night before he reached the town. Oh. He ran till he came to the farmer's pen. The ducks and the geese were kept there, and he said, "A couple of you gonna grease my chin before I leave this town, no town, no town, no. A couple of you are gonna grease my chin before I leave this town, no." And the quack, 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 and the legs all dangling down, no, down, no, down, no. He didn't mind the quack, quack, and the legs all dangling down, no. The old gray woman jumped to the bed. She ran to the window and she popped at her head. She cried, "John, John, the great goose is gone and the fox is on the town, no, town, no, town, no. John, John, the great goose is gone and the fox is on the town, no." Must be a mighty fine town, no, town, no, town, no. Daddy, daddy, go back again, for it must be a mighty fine town, no. All the fox and his wife, without any strife, they caught a black goose with a fork and a knife, and they never had such a supper in their life, and the little bones chewed on the bones, those bones, those bones, those. They never had such a supper in their life, and the little bones chewed on the bones.
Whoa, fantastic. Do you know, I am laughing at the idea of that song putting you to sleep. That's
right.
Like Rory Gallagher or somebody took the mandolin and just went running around the house. How did that work?
It didn't. I don't think it did. And I've had a miserable time getting to sleep ever since. I can stay asleep like anyone. Oh my gosh, it's difficult to wake me up, but it's really hard for me to get down. And I think that could be the problem.
I think we've diagnosed that. I think we've absolutely diagnosed it. That was really beautiful. And, you know, just can we talk about the instrument itself?
Sure,
I'm looking at it here. I'm so privileged to be just feeling feet away from you here, and I can tell that that instrument has a rich history to us. Talk to us a little bit about that really precious, that instrument you're holding there, Chris.
Absolutely. So this was made in the Gibson factory in Kalamazoo, Michigan, in the States, in 1924.
By the
sort of Stradivarius of the mandolin, this guy Lloyd Lohr, the Gibson factory hired him to sort of revive their mandolin program. Okay. And he failed to revive it. He didn't fail in making beautiful mandolins. It's just that it didn't actually revive the market at all. So they fired him, and he only got to make around 250, maybe 300 of these things. And they're considered our Stradivariuses, and they're very limited because, again, the market didn't immediately respond to his work, and Gibson was like, gah, no
gone. More. So this is the instrument that you play. This, you bring
always.
This everywhere with you. The most
always.
Precious
yeah,
thing
no matter,
you
oh gosh,
can
they
carry
tried
your
to,
luggage.
Someone was at the airline today was intimating that they thought I maybe should check it. And I was just, no, you'll have to check me.
You've
no Give
idea,
it my seat and
said.
Put me underneath.
And you've been playing this since you were 13. Why this instrument for you? What happened?
Oh, I've been playing it since I was 5, actually.
No way.
Yeah. The first record maybe came out when I was 13. But yeah, I was 5. I saw one of these things when I was 2 years old at a pizza place, of all things, in Southern California. And but, you know, initially it was less about the instrument itself for me and more about the fellow that was playing it. He was this fiercely charismatic fellow. He was a very good player, but he was also funny, told great stories, like a classic folk showman, you know? And I think, honestly, I think if he'd played kazoo, we'd be having a very different musical experience together right now.
It would have been a different journey. The bit that's fascinating about you, though, is how you move so fluidly and brilliantly, obviously, but between genres, you know, bluegrass, classical, folk. Mm. I mean, it's extraordinary to listen to you play the fox and think, he's going to be playing Bach in a minute. That, I mean, you know, you occupy a really interesting, unique space musically, don't you? I mean, you're the furthest thing from kind of a musical snob or whatever. You just want the tune, is it? What is it about?
Yeah.
What's going on in your head about this?
Well, I think you, yeah, gosh, I feel like I'm in a country of some of the most sophisticated music fans in the world here. I try and have my ears open is the main thing. I love music so much, and so I feel like it's my responsibility as a dyed-in-the-wool music lover.
Mm-hmm.
To listen to everything and then see what comes out of me naturally. You know, let all of that music that I hear sort of, you know, rub shoulders with what's inherently me and then see how that comes out. And so if Bach hits it, then I'm going to try and give you some, you know what I mean?
It's extraordinary. And you've had, you know, such a sort of success, but it's the collaborations that you really enjoy as well.
I know,
we mentioned there about Yo-Yo Ma, but I mean, Nickel Creek, for example, mm-hmm. you know, I'm looking at names like Alison Krauss working there. I mean,
yeah. You've
had a really rich musical past as well.
I do think that comes part and parcel with the open ears. And so then when you meet someone else who you recognize as, oh, you're one of the open-eared ones.
Yes,
like
you're
maybe
curious, we're you're
curious
open, yeah.
And but also, yeah, maybe speaking a different, not necessarily a different language, because music, of course, is the great universal language, but a different dialect, and one that kind of gives me a window into an area of music that I haven't necessarily gotten to explore. Like, maybe they can be my guide, and maybe I can be their guide in an area they haven't gotten to explore. That's what can be so fun about that.
I'm thinking about, and we will move on to Bach in a minute. It's quite extraordinary that we're discussing bluegrass and hopping to Bach. I have to say, that's a unique conversation. But just to go back to that for a minute, kind of the turn of the century, or sorry, 2000s right through, that was a really rich time. That's when, you know, bluegrass folk really went so mainstream as well.
Yep.
I'm thinking even, you know, A Brother Where Art Thou, the movie, you know, is that, am I right about that? Was there a feeling that it got more attention and got more into the mainstream?
It did, but there's, you know, it goes in waves, and I feel like maybe there's kind of a 25-year thing.
Metric
like,
going on.
Because if you look back, I think it was maybe 20, 25 years before Oh Brother, Where Art Thou that there was that movie Deliverance that had...
the bank.
Right?
Oh,
remember that?
Shivered down the spine of that
was,
one.
Yeah, that was a big moment for bluegrass as well. And now there's this fella back in the States. I don't know if he's made it over here yet, but Billy Strings is creating this.
Yep.
I mean, he's doing arenas as like a bluegrass musician. I mean, he plays traditional bluegrass, and he's selling out arenas in the States. So it feels like another moment that it's happening. So, you know, it comes in waves. I bet the trad scene here does that a little bit too.
Yeah.
Some movie will come out or something.
Yes, exactly. And people get a bit more confidence, I think, around.
And then it fades away, and then people start yearning for that kind of like, ooh, I want to feel tied to the earth. I want to feel tied to the human beings around me, something organic. You know what I mean?
As AI takes over our world, we rush to the strings.
It's a nice time to hear human beings do things.
Yeah.
Is what I'm saying.
Well, let's move on to Bach.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's a natural progression from bluegrass. Talk to us about this, because obviously, again, those arrangements that you're doing, again, they're claimed you've done volume one, you're heading to volume two. What is it about Bach and classical music that draws you to then? Is it the difference? Is it the formality? Is it testing yourself? What is that little joy for you there?
It's the sheer beauty of it. It's the sheer wonder that I have as a human being hearing someone with the kind of mastery that Bach had over music. All meaningful arguments about like who was the greatest musician of all time, they start at number two. Everyone agrees on number one, it was Bach. And then it gets interesting at number two.
Do they agree that it's Bach?
At least.
Where are the Mozartoids throw things at you?
You know, they're there, but even then you go. Yeah, I've had people disagree with Mozart, but then we get really in there, and I just think especially the polyphonic accomplishment of Bach. So you want as a ambitious...
Please feel free to strum away, though, because I can see you actually speak through the instrument, too.
I do.
So if you want to strum away in the background there, that's cool with us.
You know, when you get into all of this kind of thing and you hear, like, a beautiful melody, this... Right, that if you hear that much of it, that could be a fiddle tune, or it could be, like, the start of Raggle Taggle Gypsy or something, you know. Right?
Yeah.
And then you hear... Oh, and you're like, whoa, what's happening? And so to me, it was just like, okay, I engage with it just sheerly on the melodic, you know, on a melodic level. But then I hear him work with polyphony in that way. And I when I first started hearing his music, maybe 13, 14 years old, it was just, that was what instantly drew me. That was just, I was thunderstruck. It was like, wait, you can line against line against line like that? I'd only heard fiddle tunes where you're hearing a line and maybe you're hearing harmony under it. Maybe someone plays a direct harmony to it, you know. You know, like, so that's two lines moving exactly the same way together. But to hear a line against a line like that just blew the doors off for me. And I was like, I gotta see what's happening there.
So when you take the stage on tomorrow night, right, a performance like that, where it's your stage, right?
Yeah.
How do you plan it? Do you just go with a movement, a feeling? You know, do you love to test yourself and bounce around? Like, talk to me about what's going on in your head, curating, because you can sort of do anything tomorrow and the audience are going to love it.
Well, that's an interesting thing about playing solo. You talked about, like, you know, my fondness for collaboration. I have it. But then what's so fun about playing solo is then that fondness for collaboration manifests itself in a real desire to work with the people who come to the show. They are my collaborators. You is my audience right here in this room. Like, we're collaborating right now. And so I want to create a framework within which that collaboration can flower. And so, yeah, I have a set list, but I'm going to feel who comes tomorrow and we're going to take it from there. I have certain things I'm definitely going to hit. But for instance, the way I play the Fox right now probably will have little, if anything, to do with the way that I'm going to play the Fox tomorrow. and the same, honestly, with the prelude, the E major prelude that I'm going to play from the E major partita by Bach now. Again, I'll play it in a different way tomorrow. And they're also, yes, sometimes it's just like, nope, not this song, this other song instead.
Not feeling this. Yeah. Just quickly before you give us that beautiful treat that you're going to do now in a minute. We know you've been to Ireland many times. You spoke to Sean Rock so beautifully here in 2022. I listened back to that interview. Sean was clearly enjoying the conversation with you. You've already mentioned Planxty and the influence on your music, but you feel something about performing here. You return here.
Yeah, there's... my musical language is inseparable from the music that seems to kind of emanate from this place. I think about those Planxty records. There was the Paul Brady and Andy Irvine record that is just, oh my God, that stuff. There was a band from here, Seamus Egan's band, Solas, that early on I ran into them at a big radio program in the States. We shared a young artist bill together on this very influential program in the States called Prairie Home Companion. And that kind of kicked me off. I listened to this record that they were promoting at the time, Sunny Spells and Scattered Showers. And then that led me to Planxty and then to Paul Brady. And I saw, I think Paul Brady's playing the National Concert Hall this week too. I'm just like, why can't I just
shame for you? Yeah. So you just keep finding all these little connections and it keeps drawing you back.
Yeah.
And you think the audience here gets you because you get where their cultural
God, I would love to think there's a symbiosis like that. That we speak a very kind of different dialects, but mm-hmm. very much the same language. And God, talk about polyphony. That's a thing that exists, I think, in a very real way in traditional Irish music, that I don't hear as much in bluegrass. And that was one of the things that drew me in. There is a more of a tradition of line against line in y'all's folk music than there is in ours.
Well, let's go for it. You're going to play us out. Please do. This is from the E major partita for solo violin, Bach, of course. This is a little prelude, but this is not what you're going to hear tomorrow night at the concert, because you'll play a different version of it.
You never know.
Chris, all right, take it away, please.
Of course, my pleasure. Thanks again for having me. Thank you.
Bravo. My thanks to you, Chris Thiele. And Chris and his magical 1924 mandolin will be at the National Concert Hall tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Full details on nch.ie. And you're very welcome back to Arena. And joining me in studio now is the writer, director and actor Liam O'Mahon, because he's here to talk about his new film, Abode. It's his new film that is about the idea of home. So whether it's a homeless people living on the streets at Christmas or a well-to-do young couple grappling with voice-activated domestic appliances, the tales take us through a range of twists and emotions as we try to work out what is going on. Each story seems quite ordinary, quite familiar, but nothing is as much as it seems in Abode. In the central story, Rose Henderson plays Molly, wife to Frank Sr., mother to two adult children, and on the day of an unnamed family occasion that is stressing her out. And I'm delighted that Os Morgan with Liam and Shailin Anocht, and that Rose Henderson, that both of you are in studio. Liam, this is a tough one now, right? Because we've got five stories to talk about, but we don't want to give away any spoilers, right? So we have to kind of tread gently and delicately around here. But we are told initially that they are inspired by true stories. That yes. word, abode, why that word for you? What was it?
I wanted a word that wasn't used a lot. Like, obviously, you know the term as humble abode or no fixed abode. It's always been used. But home has been used a lot, and there's hundreds of titles and movies with home in it. And there's no, I think there's a short film called Abode, and that's it. So I have it all to myself. But also the other part of it is that when you go to look for the movie, it's the first one that comes up. It's A. It's in the alphabet. So up here, up there for
clever
dancing.
Move.
Yes,
clever move.
Exactly.
Okay. So what you've done is you've created five stories, right? Exploring, as you say, the broadest sense possible, this theme. We have to look and talk about your own backstory. You come to this as a writer with really a unique perspective, okay? Your childhood, you know, you'd have, I think it's fair to say, a fairly extraordinary childhood that gave you a different view on life than maybe usual that we'd have with writers coming into the studio here.
Seemed normal at the time.
Yeah,
but everything seems normal when you're growing up, when you're going through stuff. But
how
yes.
do you tell that story?
How do I tell that story? I bore my friends and people that I meet to death telling them about my story and think, oh my God, that would make a great documentary or a film or whatever. But what I tell them about is that my parents were alcoholics. They lived on the streets, and this is in the early 70s, and quite a few of their kids were taken off them, myself included, with two real sisters, and we were brought up on a farm in the west of Ireland, the three of us, and then other siblings were sent to other places across the west of Ireland as well. And sometimes we'd meet maybe twice a year or at Christmas or different times, but would have spent the first year or year and a half with the biological parents and then ended up in like a children's home in Clifton, and different families would take kids out as a trial. So I would have been trialed out for a few different families until I ended up with the particular family I was with from about 2.5 till I was 18. And then it was kind of normal. It seemed normal. From that point onwards, if you know what I mean. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's normal. You're still, when you're fostered, you know that you're fostered. You've been told, because there's court cases all the time, every couple of years. Whereas when you're adopted, sometimes you might find out, sometimes you won't find out. So you kind of have that, you know, knowledge all the way through it. So coming to a film like this, you know, I kind of understand the both belonging and abandonment, and also the need for home, and everybody has a need or a want for home, and it doesn't really matter what that home is to them, whether, as I said in the blurb, whether it's a mansion or whether you're on the street, for everybody it has a different meaning. So I don't know if that answers your question.
That's one of the best answers I've heard about, tell me about your childhood. I mean, that's a fairly extraordinary childhood and an amazing. You tell it, you know, as you say, you've talked about it before, but how it informs your storytelling is really powerful.
Yes, and I suppose it kind of gives me a different perspective. It gives me both the perspective of being on the outside, but also being on the inside at the same time. And that's kind of what it kind of does, if you know what I mean. So I do understand in the story of the family who are homeless, and obviously we have so much stories in the news all the time, and numbers, as we know, are going up all the time. So it's something that's relevant, that's always there, and obviously resonates with people as well. That particular story resonates with people. But then also you have other stories, you know, in it that also will resonate. And as you said, it's very hard to talk about something when you can't give the twist away, because there's twists in lots of different stories. And Rose's story is just another really beautiful story. I mean, say a beautiful story that I found, not sort of bigging myself up there saying I created a beautiful story, but she just gives an extraordinary performance of on a particular day, in a day and time. I think it's probably just set over less than an hour, that particular story, and it's about 17, 18 minutes of, you know, one of the five stories, and she just is extraordinary in it, you know. I just, yeah.
But what Label's done, given that start, is that he's given a very positive outcome to something. And there is a moment.
I was about to say, there's a lot of joy in this. I don't want people to think that it's, you know, that sense of just one perspective on it. I mean, you're very generous as a writer in this.
Absolutely.
Rose, we meet you and you're stressed out of your brain. Yes. And you're running around the house driving yourself and everybody mad.
Can't decide what to wear. It's a big event.
It's a big event.
And you can feel the stress rising and rising as we get
And you're trying to get somewhere within an hour. And the whole family's going, calm down. We don't know what's wrong with you.
They're sitting at home. They're not. Nobody's ready.
They're driving mad.
I want to go, but they are being supportive. They're there for me. And my lovely husband, who's played by Donica Crowley, is literally saying, and I'm stabbing him with wounds.
He's, you know, a saint of a husband.
But he's absolutely, like, I'd bring him home myself. He's
didn't have a husband already.
If I didn't have a lovely husband already. But he's so you don't know what it is that she's going to, but as it becomes clear, Liam has managed to give a moment that literally every woman in Ireland will go, oh.
Yeah.
And we recognise it. And I haven't had that story, but I completely, when I read the script, said, oh yeah, that's beautiful.
But is the challenge for you, there are five stories in this, it's almost like a cinematic version of a collection of short stories.
It's a collage. It's
so
beautiful.
You just come in for your bit with Donoch and the lads or whatever. You have to kind of own that story and try and tell that story. You don't know about necessarily what the companion other
Not at all. We hadn't even met each other until we saw it
so
in Galway.
So what was the direction from him? What was the note to you in this moment, in this sitting where you're stressed out of your brain trying to get out of the house?
It's just be yourself, be in the stress moment for now, and then it resolves, and then you see where she's going, and then you see what the husband is saying to her, and then you see that another flash of annoyance, and then you see her in this extraordinary thing where the shift happens that I can't talk about, and the moment happens, and we all, and what Liam did was he gave time to that. So you know that he's sorted out the cameras, we sorted out the people in the background, and it's all. But it becomes this bubble of something extraordinarily beautiful. And he just gave time for that. And he's in it. So he's the link in the five stories. Mm. And actually, he trusts the audience. There's a real game that he plays.
He does.
Like, where's he going to turn up?
Where's Wally?
And you mess with some of the camera shots as well. Now, we're going to hear you in action, Rose Henderson, to prove that you're in this film. We have a little clip of you as Molly. And you're there with the family. And I think tensions are rising here. But here's a little flavour of just one of these five stories, but it's the one that you're in. So here, a little taster of from the film Abode.
Your 40s, Frankie. Still can't dress yourself. Patricia, please put the phone down. We're supposed to be gone. Look, why am I the only one who's ready?
I was checking the route.
Your dad has done that already.
I'm taking my own car.
I would prefer if we all went together as a family.
Mum, relax. It's going to be fine. It will.
Are you ready for it? Big day.
Frank, stop. She's fine. You are okay, aren't you, Mum?
I don't know.
Has the word relax ever worked?
Are you in bad form, are you?
You know, seriously, I was with you now. You're nagging away, but I was with you for the relaxed bit. So the bit that I want to talk to you, Liam, about is you had these five stories, right? And there's great fun in it and great joy and mystery. And you're a messer as well. And you're bold as a writer and you push us. And, you know, you really have fun at it at times as well. But you didn't interweave them. You've kept them as five separate stories together. What? Talk to me about that choice.
I did it because the previous film I did was Lost and Found. And there were seven stories in that. And they were, the characters jumped from story to story in that one. And you found out different things about them. And I just thought that they also could have stood on their own. So I decided on this particular one not to give them chapter titles, but just give them like an image that encompasses the story coming up and gives you an idea. And also gives you a little bit of a breather in between them, maybe like 10 seconds, because apparently we're like goldfish. We need about 10 seconds to forget the previous thing that we've seen or talked about or whatever. So I wanted five stories that kind of stood on their own. But also when you watch them as a collection, you get a different type of feeling and a different sort of, like you would with an album with singles, if you listen to it, or as you said earlier, short stories. And you just get a particular type of feeling from it, from seeing the whole thing, not just seeing individual ones that still had to work on their own.
So what are your hopes for this film? You know, it's been getting a great reaction. What are you hoping?
Well, I think with most filmmakers, if you're doing something that is these type of stories and sort of social realism, you're hoping that you both educate and entertain. Because there's no point, you know, depressing somebody or people, an audience.
You know what? I'm really keen that people understand that there's every colour in the palette. Isn't there, Rose?
Yes.
Like, there's no lecturing, there's no anything. It's an absolute joy the way it unfolds.
And there's one terribly funny one
hysterical.
Tales of the Unexpected twist in it.
And young couple in a great house. We'll all be loving the house. But, you know, again, a really unexpected twist there. You like messing with your audience.
I love
challenging
twists. Yeah. I love having an audience watch something, and I've given you crumbs throughout it. And the crumbs are just normal things that you would just be normal. That then once you come to towards the end, you go, that's why these things happened. That seemed normal at the time. And I kind of like that. And it's kind of nice to have a twist at the end. And I also like that house as well. It's not mine. The one with the oven story. And that was really sort of an homage to Roald Dahl, sort of Tales of the Unexpected TV shows
exactly
we used to watch in the 80s.
That's exactly what you're thinking of when you're watching it.
Yeah, and
it,
Black Mirror today, and also how AI is taking over our life.
The final one, the last story, it feels like in a way that brings a lot of the angles of what you're trying to cover home. It's very poignant and funny and sweet, but there's that little kick at the end.
There's a little kick at the end, and there's a couple of twists and stuff in there, and the performances by Mary Murray and Stephen Jones is great. And I happen to get my own two kids in there as well. And they're peppered throughout other stories as well. And they first said they didn't want to be in the film because they said it wasn't a Marvel, it wasn't a superhero movie. And then when they said if they could get paid, and they negotiated for each other
a
fee.
They were more expensive than we were.
So,
revolutionary moment.
And they got paid first.
Good for them.
Because I had to go home.
I never knew that.
Yeah.
Rose, when you get offered a part like that, I mean, what a joy to just dive straight into something that's complete.
Totally. And as well, for me, it was something that wasn't comedy. And that, again, the trust that Liam had that I could, you know, it's that your fear.
Oh, you felt like the Irish mammy. You know, you felt really familiar.
Yeah, but I was pleased that I had this trust in it, and that he was saying all the way through the day when we were recording it, that's it, move on. No, you've got it. You know, which is beautiful. It's just when you're watching this film, and what Liam does again is the last story, even though it's that horrible when you find out what's happened to them, there's this huge uplift. Mm-hmm. We believe that this has happened to them. Can't tell you what it is, but they, you know, and you actually leave going, there's hope, the silver lining.
Yeah, and
is
I think that's very generous of you, actually, as a writer and director, to leave us with that.
I think so. I think you sometimes you need something.
Yeah.
It's important. And I go to the cinema all the time. I go maybe twice, three times a week. And if I see a movie that's not great or not good or depressing, it just annoys me. And I just think it's important to, you know, you don't have to give an audience something all the time. But I think a little bit of hope would be great every now and again.
We could all do with a bit of hope. Yes. We're going to end on a little clip. This is from Sam and Skylar, and this is part of that story we're talking about that's set in the beautiful house. But this is the little nod to the Tales of Unexpected. It just gives people a little flavour, another colour really from the palette that you've used in this film about. Here, Sam, Matthew O'Brien, all he wanted was a new TV. And then Skylar, played by Gail Brady, spots a voice-activated oven. This salesman here is played by Jed Murray.
I don't like the cooker. It doesn't do anything.
It's a cooker. I just want a TV. We went out for a TV.
Well, we've loads of those. Whatever you want. We've a TV in a mirror. We've a refrigerator with a TV in it. We've a couch over there with a TV hidden in it.
So it's not just the remote you have to find.
Get one that talks to you.
That's too freaky. I just want a TV.
And we will. Give me a few more minutes.
Oh, and he doesn't know what's coming next. My thanks to Liam O'Wachan, Gormil Margaret Liam and Rose Henderson. Through. The best of luck with it all. And Abode is in Irish cinemas now. Now we're moving on to Irish Design Week with the rate from Design and Crafts Council Ireland taking place across the country. And this celebration of creativity attracts international designers every year. And later this week, acclaimed graphic artist Anthony Burrill will be giving a talk at the National Print Museum in Dublin, with examples of his work in the permanent collections of the V&A and the Design Museum of London, and also in galleries in New York. He is renowned for his remarkable ability to distill ideas into simple yet striking forms. His printed works remain instantly recognisable, gracing countless walls and homes and offices with their powerful messages. And I am delighted that Anthony joins me on the line this evening. Good evening, Anthony. How are you?
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Yeah, all good. Looking forward to heading over to Dublin tomorrow. So, yeah, it's going to be a good few days.
Listen, busy up there. That's a busy week they have going on there for the Design Council. But let's talk about your work. And I hope you don't mind. This is going to be a very clumsy description, right? But we're on radio, so I'm trying to get, you know, a little sense of this across to our listeners. You can check out our Instagram. We've posted some examples of Anthony's work. It's there at RTE_arena. But in essence, Anthony, and again, I'm apologising for the clumsiness, you create posters with words, not with kind of pictures as such. Boldly striking words, like, for example, you do like an and, you do like an ampersand. But say the most iconic one is the one that blares out that great message: work hard and be nice to people. And that's the entire poster. And people know the look of it. Why this form for you? Why do you like this kind of way of conveying your messages and exploring your messages?
I just think it's, you know, words connect and communicate so simply. You know, I don't think it's... I think it's just the sort of direct nature of communicating through words that really appeals to me, and that you can connect with lots of different people from lots of different backgrounds. You know, they don't have to have a kind of like deep understanding of art kind of to understand what I'm trying to get across, really. And I just love typography, and I love letter forms, and the kind of production method that I use, letterpress, you know, dates back hundreds of years. So, yeah, there's that aspect to it as well.
Yeah, I mean, the printing, the act of printing, the ink, the letterpress, that has a charm for you, doesn't it? You know, talk to us about how you use that as an artist.
Yes, definitely. And I think it's that, you know, I use like vintage wood letter type that's kind of hand set. And the kind of presses that I use are over 100 years old. So, but I love that connection with the history of design and the history of visual communication and production. So to make a piece of work at the National Print Museum was a real joy.
Now, that first one that I'm talking about there, work hard and be nice to people, it was kind of a quiet success, wasn't it? I mean, I think you were obviously in London, you were in Manchester. I was reading your CV with Envy, you were in the Hacienda when it was, you know, the place to be. You'd have that kind of rock and roll lifestyle. Then family comes along and suddenly things change and you move to Rye, that beautiful, beautiful village in Sussex, I think, in England. And that starts really a new chapter, is that fair to say, for you, you know, in a way of expressing your work. Talk to us a little bit about the print and community you met in Rye and how that influenced what you produced.
Yeah, definitely. I think, I studied graphic design in the kind of 80s and 90s, and then I was in London for like 15 years working commercially through, you know, working with ad agencies and things. And I think that's where I really kind of learnt my craft of kind of working with words especially. And then, yeah, when we had children and we moved down to Rye in East Sussex, the centre of the town is a print workshop called Adams of Rye. And they've been in the town for over 100 years. And it just felt, for me, it was like a real connection with that kind of real analogue way of making work that, you know, wasn't computer-based. It was kind of handcrafted and handmade. And I think that, that kind of production really suited what I wanted to say at the time. So yeah, it's 20 years ago that I made the Work Hard and Be Nice to People poster, and it's still connecting with people.
It's amazing that you found that, you know, that Adam's there in this village, in this place, and it's been such a wonderful collaboration for you. But I want to ask you about optimism, right? And rejecting cynicism. You know, and your messages are so positive. You know, I like it. What is it? Think of your own ideas. Ask more questions. You know more than you think you do. That's important to you, is it? To have that kind of twist on your philosophy, that positive outlook.
Yeah, definitely. It's like your previous guest said, you know, it's good to give people a bit of hope. And, you know, I'm eternally optimistic. You know, I always have been. And I think, you know, I think if you kind of get your work out there into the world and you communicate with people and you connect with like-minded people especially, then, you know, you can really travel far and wide with your work. And it's something, you know, I've always kind of lived by that ethos of kind of optimism and openness and connection. And, it's something that's definitely worked for me and something I want to communicate with people.
Finally then, in the lead up to Design Week, you have been spending time, you mentioned there, at the National Print Museum in Dublin, collaborating with the printers there. Just to tell us a little bit about that, because I know to launch it, you'll be giving a Q&A style talk this Thursday evening. But just tell us quickly about that project.
Well, I was contacted by Carla, the director of the museum, a couple of months ago. And she said, do you think this is a kind of project you'd be interested in doing, you know? And it's like immediately I saw pictures of the museum and, you know.
It's really beautiful, isn't it? I mean, it's walk through time. It's such a privilege to have it here, yeah.
Yeah, it's an incredible place. And the people who work there are just amazing.
Printers volunteer there. I've been down there. They're happy to talk to you about the work. You know, it really is a special place.
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's well worth a trip down there to see all the presses and things. I kind of quickly travelled over and worked for a couple of days there and put this new print together that simply says Hope. It's in four big letters on the print. We found these like really like oversized wood letter type letters, and we just kind of put it together. Really, it came together like kind of quite sort of fortuitously, really.
So we've been talking about that word, and it turns out that is the key word to unlock this project.
Yes, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think, you know, hope is, you know, it springs eternal, doesn't it, in the human spirit. And I think especially, you know, this year and, you know, we've all seen, you know, the way that the world is at the moment. And I think to kind of keep that fire burning inside, you know, the hope that things can change and can get better. It's something that keeps us all going.
Well, Anthony, thank you for coming over and sharing your work and your optimism with us all. I really hope you enjoy that, you know, the launch of that project. Thank you so much for joining us on the programme this evening. And if you're interested, all details about Anthony's talk this Thursday as part of Ireland's Design Week can be found at nationalprintmuseum.ie. August 4 to Rashgadi Arena and Shaw Air Ehidze. You're very welcome back to Arena on this Tuesday night with me, Evelyn O'Rourke. Now, Dublin, as we know, renowned for the striking examples of stained glass that are on display in buildings stretching right across the capital. During the 20th century, particularly, its international reputation for artistry and craftsmanship soared, and leading figures emerged, such as Harry Clarke, Michael Healy, Evie Hone. And happily, significant collections of their work remain readily available for us all to see. But now, a new book will guide us all through some of the finest stained glass windows that we can see. Called Dublin Stained Glass, A Guide to the Finest 20th Century Windows, it's a recently published book by art historian Dr. David Caron, and he'll also be giving a talk on the subject in Dublin this Thursday evening. But Dr. Caron joins me in the studio now. You're very welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
Now, David, we have to start by saying we know that there's beautiful stained glass across the country. Dublin does not have sole ownership. I'm going to start mentioning things like in Tullamore, for example, and Mullingar. And maybe what I'm going to think about is if people want to text in their examples of beautiful places locally to them, we would love to hear about it this evening. But for this book, you focused on the Dublin examples.
I did, because there's quite a concentration in Dublin. The studios were all based in Dublin. Are the key ones. There were three key ones. And all the artists lived in Dublin. And so consequently, a lot of their very good examples of their work can be seen for free throughout Dublin City and County.
Well, let's get into that. I mean, that's such a simple idea, but it's totally accessible for free because the work that you talk about in particular, it's in places that the public can access, mainly religious buildings, obviously, but galleries and other places too. Mm-hmm. But that is a key charm to this art form, isn't it?
I think it is. I mean, they're open. You can wander in at any time. You can spend as long as you like. And they're usually quiet, you know, contemplative spaces, I suppose. So they kind of encourage people to linger. And for the most part, you're not going to be bothered by people. You know, they're not overrun by visitors. So, you know, it's kind of a nice time out place just to enjoy the stained glass.
Now, the book is an absolute visual feast. Fascinating insights into over 100 works in stained glass in 38 buildings throughout Dublin City and County. You know, and you've gone out of your way to find the ones that are easily accessible and free of charge. But the idea is, I think, that you've given this kind of guide that people could clutch in their hand and make their way around areas in Dublin that they may know. You find the work and you look into your book and there it is, and you've literally done a road by road guide to all these. Was that important to you, that it was practical, that you wanted people to bring this book out of the house, out of the library, and hit the road with it?
It was, really. It's not a slim book, but I wanted it to be kind of comprehensive and sort of a deep dive into the windows. So it does really tell you a lot about the background, who the artists were, the techniques they used, the symbolism that might be contained in the imagery, something about the donors, and also very much how the designers, artists responded to the architecture, because in all these cases, the artists visited the churches. This was really important, and they looked at the aspect, north, south, east or west, the height from the ground that it would be viewed from. So I wanted to kind of bring all that to the fore so that it would be kind of a rich experience, and this would be like a companion to you when you travel around Dublin.
Now, stained glass, it has a curious effect on our senses, really. And so many of us have been maybe at a service or a concert or an event, and the light suddenly hits that stained glass window, and just there's something happens. It's just compelling for us. We're very drawn to it, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. I mean, it is kind of can be beguiling. I think Harry Clark, who you mentioned, and Michael Healy as well, they used a particular technique that involved beeswax resist and hydrofluoric acid. Quite complicated. I won't go into it in detail. But what it did mean is that there were pinpricks of pure light coming through the glass. And in our ever-changing cloud formation climate, it really animates the windows. So they become sparkling, and there's almost a magical effect. So it's not a static art form the way maybe sculpture or painting might be.
Yes, it can look different sort of every time.
They're
coming in from around the country. We have Dunarian King's Court in Cavan. There's Evie Hone windows there. Absolutely wonderful, says Brona. Her mum was from
That's
there.
Right, there are. I've seen them several times.
Volume two. There's a Harry Clark and St. Luke window in Castle Townsend in County Cork.
Brilliant windows.
And I love the Harry Clark stained glass windows in the dessert in Dingle from Chile. So there you go. That's part two, right? You'll get out on the road. Going back to this, though, for a minute, I mean, let's pick one or two. I mean, Bewley's Cafe, right? There's so much talk about that. It was in the newspapers, obviously, during the year and everything. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about the Harry Clarks that are there.
Well, there's six windows in total. There's a series of four that are probably the finer four that are, as you go into the cafe, that the ones you see ahead of you, which the theme is the orders of architecture. So you've got these sort of columns with the Doric, Ionic, Tuscan and Corinthian. What's really magical about them is that they're full of little animals and insects and birds. And there's kind of a parchment-coloured background, but it's really a combination of part aquarium and part aviary. And it's just amazing, mystical, doesn't make any sense. And there's little extraterrestrial characters as well. So it's really, I suppose, bewitching in a way. And it's one that really draws us in, like a lot of Clark's work. It's the detail that delights us.
And there's also, I mean, there's Harry Clark examples right through, and you talk about that. But, you know, let's mention the window in St. Peter's and Paul's Church in Balbriggan. Mm-hmm. And then that small, recently purchased panel in the National Gallery.
Yeah, I mean, it's tiny. It's a cabinet panel. It's only 7.5 inches by 12. And it uses this aceting technique, and it depicts a scene from the Midsummer Night's Dream. And it's very theatrical, but it's just astonishing in its detail and the richness of colour. And it was made, the original bespoke little cabinet that was created for it, it's in it still.
Now, Evie Hone, another name. Again, more texts coming in here. Magnificent stained glass windows in the Sacred Heart Church in Templemore in County Tipperary. Well worth a visit, says Patricia, especially in the afternoon when the sun comes in, which is what we're talking about there. St. Michael's Church in Gertine, County Galway has Harry Clark windows and Harry Clark's studio window in the Augustine Abbey in Feathered in Tipperary too, says Jasper. So everybody's enjoying their this conversation about the stained glass window. But talk to me then about Evie Hone. You know, she's such a distinctive approach.
Yeah. She did. She was an interesting character. She was very devout. She tried to be an Anglican nun at one point and didn't stay for a year or so. But her approach was very, very different to the other artists. She used very rich colours, so they really can take very intense sun. And they're kind of primal in a way, I think. She was an abstract painter, and I think the fact that her painting style, the actual brush strokes, are very visible in her work. She had really no interest in the detail that Clark or Healy enjoyed. And they're profoundly sort of religious and moving artworks. They're great examples, five in Manresa's House of Spirituality in Dollymount. Terrific set.
I'm just flicking through here and people are texting on 51551 with their local stained glass. But, you know, you've got Santry, you've got Donnybrook, you've done Leary, you've Kimmage, you've Dollymount, as you mentioned there, Ballymun, Malahide, Dublin Airport. Mm-hmm. You know, really, this is going to open people's eyes to it, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you mentioned Dublin Airport. They're interesting because they're a series of 14 Stations of the Cross by a little known artist called Sheila Corcoran. And they're very expressionistic and quite abstract, and Archbishop McQuaid took a profound dislike to them, so much so that he had them instructed for them to be removed, and they were. And then it was only after his death that they were reinstated.
They were banned. That's a first now.
That's a first. Hopefully a last as well.
So sort of unpicking those histories was fascinating for you.
It was. Yeah, I really enjoyed that. I mean, I love research, and there were very interesting stories often, and it was just amount of unpicking them, like you say, and revealing their secrets in some instances as well.
Now, you get to pick your own favourite one. Tell us about yours.
Well, I guess if the four great artists are Harry Clark, Michael Healy, Evie Hone, Wilhelmina Geddes. I love all of their work. But I'll pick a window by another artist. That's by Richard King, who had trained at Harry Clark. And he has this amazing sort of tour de force window, vast window. It's really the entire gable end of the church in Green Hills. And it depicts Pentecost, the arrival of the tongues of fire of the Holy Spirit on Pentecost. And it actually featured in the Kin series about the
an unlikely
first, yeah,
which shows the drama of
it
that
showed
kind
the
of
drama backdrop. Yes, and I you know, it's an entire wall. It's 84 panels set into a concrete matrix.
Well, there you go. Dr. David Caron, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Your recently published book, Dublin Stained Glass, A Guide to the Finest 20th Century Windows, is published by Four Courts Press, and David will be presenting a talk on the subject this Thursday evening at 6:30 p.m. at Pier Street Library in Dublin City Centre. For more information, just go to hughlane.ie. Well, that leaves me with just to say that is it for the show this evening. Research was by Leah Murphy. Broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. Mark McGraw was on sound. And tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. John Creedon is up next after the news. Slán go fóill.